In today's episode, I talked with Sean Tepper, the founder and COO of Ticker, which is a stock screener. So if you want to invest in stocks or ETFs or crypto or whatever, this website is helping you getting the right data. It's a typical SaaS startup. So we're talking mostly not about stocks and whatever, because I have no idea about that. We are talking about pricing, we are talking about YouTube, marketing, monetization, his first steps from trading. In the beginning, just an Excel sheet, and then in the long run, software tooling, and his long-term goal with the whole project. So jump right in. I'm happy that you're here. Let's get it started. Hello and welcome back to a new Digital Economics episode. Today I'm talking with Sean Tepper, who's the CEO of Ticker. Hey, Sean, can you explain what Ticker is and what you're doing there?
Sure. Luis, thanks for having me on the show. Really appreciate it. So yeah, I'll kind of give you the backstory here on Ticker, and then we can kind of talk about the business model a little bit. So my background is about 20 years in business. I actually got into the agency world after graduating from college, and that was around 2006. And then I learned that business model, created my own agency around that time, and then did that for about 4 years. Our business model was helping small and mid-sized businesses building custom software, building custom websites. This is when like WordPress and Joomla were kind of like becoming a thing. Didn't make like any money through the recession, but learned a lot about different business models. In the fourth year, we did go through a little bit of a growth spurt, and a larger agency approached us and said, hey, we would like you to merge with us. And I needed a change. I was pretty sick of the service business model. So went through that merger. Then in 2010, I was able to step away. And with that merger, just for context there, it wasn't like a check was written like, hey, we're going to buy your business. Here's $1 million. It was none of that. Service businesses, as you probably know and your audience knows as well, very low profit margins. So there wasn't like an EBITDA multiple. So it was all debts and liabilities wiped clean. That was the win. So then I got into investing. And at the same time, I started getting into corporate contracting. I did a lot of work with companies like GE as well as Kohler in project management. But anyway, I asked myself the question, how do I flip the equation instead of me working for money? How do I flip that so money's working for me? And I knew like investing was the way. Investing, there are a lot of people who have become millionaires, multimillionaires, and even billionaires from the stock market. So I got into it. I actually tried angel investing at first, investing in private companies, and didn't really have any big wins there. But it was really around 2015 when I got serious and I got disciplined and said, let's focus on the stock market only. So I turned to Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. I realized those guys are able to consistently beat the market. And the question is how. We both know they're not gambling men. They're not using emotions or feelings, which means they're starting with logic. So what I did there is I really applied my engineering background or project management background, created an Excel sheet, started throwing in different equations from Warren Buffett, some from a guy by the name of Phil Town, and created a system in Excel that kind of gamifies the rating system of a stock. Like from 0 to 100, is it a good stock or bad stock I should avoid? Because as you know, and you can imagine, there's a lot of bad advice out there on YouTube and Reddit and Twitter, and the list goes on. So how do you know if somebody's giving you a good recommendation or a really bad recommendation? So I wanted that solution. And over the course of 4 or 5 years, I made returns that range between 15 and 50% per year. And the market average, for context, there is about 6 to 8% after inflation. So I'm like, all right, so I'm beating the market. But it really was in 2019, I started sharing this Excel sheet with a few people, retail investors, just regular people like you and I. And everybody was like, hey, when are you going to turn this into a software to share with others? So it's literally like 10 years later, I finally have a SaaS idea I can execute on. It took about a year to build the first version. We went live in 2020, and then it took 6 months to get the first paying customer. But I have built a lot of software by this point. So I knew that's the journey. What you want to do is you want to bring on customers for free, your early customers, but get feedback really fast. So that was the mission. Then monetized it, then, you know, kept iterating from there. And as of today, we actually just crossed 9,000 customers in about 50 countries. And our model, I'll keep it really simple, and then I'll turn it back to you. We're a B2C SaaS subscription platform for the retail investor. It's a screener and educational platform all in one. So people can log in and they can look at everything from like Apple to Microsoft to Tesla, whatever. And they'll know, hey, is this a good stock or bad stock? And then we do teach them everything they need to know along the way. Like, when do you buy? When do you sell? How do you reduce risk? So yeah, that's our model.
All right, let's pause for a moment and let me introduce you to today's sponsor, DealFront. It can be a struggle to reach decision makers, but imagine this, a tool that helps you target ideal fit leads and close deals all within a single platform. More than 10,000 companies, including Amazon, Telecom, Hertz, Siemens, Bubble, and Deutsche Bahn use DealFront to find new customers and increase their sales. The platform provides comprehensive company information, identifies purchase intent, and automatically directs website visitors as leads to your CRM system. The seamlessly integrated tools help target decision makers in your desired companies, convert website visitors into potential customers, and approach companies at the right time. With DealFront, you get three layers of data: market signals, web visitors, and European company databases, plus it's GDPR compliant. Quickly pinpoint decision makers, grab their direct contact details, and start meaningful conversations with DealFront. Head over to dealfront.com for a free demo today. Okay, back to the episode.
In that time, like, really stupid, naive question, but to invest, you needed money. Where did that money come from? So what was your business during that time to organize the money you were able to invest then in stocks?
Yeah, that was a problem with the service business, because I wasn't really making any money. And it was we had five employees, but it was high liabilities, high payroll. So there were many months where I didn't even take a paycheck. But when I went on my own to do corporate contracting, that's when my personal income kind of skyrocketed. People don't know, a lot of IT jobs out there, whether it's a software engineer or project manager or business analyst, system analyst, and a lot of these jobs, with just a few years experience in the US, at least, you can be making high five figures. So we're talking 80, 90K. And a lot of these jobs will pay over 100K. You don't really get above the 200 mark. And depending on what company you work for, if you work like in Silicon Valley or work for a large tech company, then you can start earning like 200, 300, 400. But yeah, I kind of landed around that six figure mark. And that was enough, because my overhead was pretty low, just living on my own, renting. And I was like, all right, so I've got some income here I can start playing with in the market.
And now I logged into your software tooling, and I see you're really transparent with what you're yourself investing in. Is this part of a whole story, like letting people know like your own investments and how you use the whole thing?
Sure. Yeah, I'll actually describe in three ways how Ticker is different from competitors, and hopefully these will be some good takeaways your audience can use when they're creating their own SaaS. So number one, we are open source. And what we mean by that is not the actual code is, but all the calculations. So we actually tell our customers, if you're interested, you can go use our calculations, which if you go to ticker.com, which is just our front-facing free site, it's a blog and educational articles and whatnot. There's a tab that says education. Then you can drop that down and see calculations. And there it walks you through everything. And we tell our customers, you can go create your own version of Ticker. However, we still hope you stay with us. But to date, after 3.5 years, nobody's actually executed on trying to duplicate Ticker. Creating a software is pretty hard, as you know. So that's number one. Number two is people can actually see my portfolio. They can see the stocks I hold. They can see the allocation percentages. And that's another level of transparency. That's the key word, transparency. If you can be transparent to your customers, you will increase trust. It's a great way to separate yourself from other companies. So, and I hold this is not financial advice, but I hold a lot of the usual suspects like Microsoft and Apple, Google, Palantir. I'm really big on Palantir. There's a few others in there as well, like Atlassian. But yeah, people.
One question. I think we shouldn't dive too deep into investments because I have no fucking idea. But one thing I was wondering about is PayPal, because I have a little story with PayPal. I have one bank account where the bank was telling me, like, yeah, now we want to charge you money for your bank account. And I was like, hey, I'm not going to pay for that. I don't pay for a bank account. So I close it. And then they were calling me and were saying, okay, if you have like a Sparplan, like saving money on a monthly basis within one stock, then it's free forever. And I was like, okay, then I'm doing that. And since then, I think like since 6 years, I am buying like a tiny part of PayPal since this time. And everyone who knows the PayPal stocks knows that was a horrible idea. Since when are you like really confident that PayPal is going back?
Now this, I won't dive too much into details with investing, but there's a strategy we use with buying stocks and selling stocks. With selling stocks, one of the rules is you do not sell for a loss. It's called rule one investing. It's actually a mindset that Warren Buffett teaches is rule one, don't lose money. Rule two, don't forget rule one. So PayPal, my cost basis is higher than the price it is right now, but I don't care because I'm a long-term investor in PayPal. Now, I will say this, PayPal's financials are not the best in ticker. However, I look at the business model. They are in 200 countries and territories, payment tech. When it comes to scalability, and I could really go into down a rabbit hole on this, you've got ad tech, payment tech, and SaaS. Ad tech and payment tech do not have monthly limitations with how much they charge their customers. Highly scalable. So PayPal are already in 200 countries and territories, and they've got like, they've got dozens of revenue streams within their model, not just one. So for me, I was really pleased to see the new CEO come in, Alex Chriss, in 2023, and they're making some changes here. So for the long term, I have high conviction, but you're right. That has not been a high-flying stock in my portfolio. But again, things are going to happen, and you got to roll with the punches, and you do not sell for a loss. I'll put it that way.
I think during zwischen den Zeilen in German, shit, my English is horrible today. But between the lines, you recognize that this is really a topic you're 100% into, and you really like. Do you think that's a big part of like being able to create a cool startup, that you really are into the topic and not only doing it for earning money?
Yeah, so I'll give you a statistic here. So 92% of SaaS businesses fail in the first 3 years, and it's not because of the business, it's because of the founders. They lose momentum, they lose interest, they lose passion, and they move on. You have to be passionate about what you're into, otherwise it's really not going to survive, because you're going to have tough times, and you're going to ask yourself the question, like, am I solving problems and do I enjoy this? And I will say this, like, the road with ticker has not always been pretty. And I have to ask myself that question. Like, I love this, and I have customers that are very thankful. And I'm like, okay, because of those two things, I'm going to continue driving forward. So I could obviously talk about stocks all day, talk about businesses. That it is my passion. I love it.
Okay, let's jump back to the point where you had the Excel list and the Excel sheet. And some people said, like, yeah, that's pretty useful. Would be cool if you do a software tool out of it. How did you start? Like, did you get like external developers? Did you hire employees? Did you code it, the stuff yourself? What was the first step you were taking?
Yeah, so context there, my job, like most of my career, has been project management, sometimes product ownership, sometimes scrum master. And I've worked with software engineers all over the globe. So I know you're in the EU, like I've worked with engineers in the US, France, Germany, India, Bangladesh, really all over the world. And I have already had relationships with teams out of India. So I hired one team to help with the MVP. I'll be transparent on pricing here. Like, that Excel sheet, turning it into an MVP was about $30,000, and bootstrapping it with another agency. Now, I will say this, the first firm I went with, they were decent at WordPress sites and some custom work, but when it came to building a SaaS, they were horrible. They were way out of their depth and they could not make progress, especially when it came to setting up payment tiers. And it was like something foreign for them. And I'm like, okay, so we're done with you. Moved on to team two, which was actually a single guy who I've worked with before. And he was able to get me the MVP. He could bring it across the finish line. But again, total was 30 grand. And then from there, it was like iterations, getting feedback from customers. And then we went to a V2 and then eventually V3, which we're on today.
And you have a pricing model which ranges, but I guess most people get the middle. Like every SaaS business has like these three pillars, and you choose the one in the middle. I don't know if it's the same for you, but I guess most people choose the one in the middle, which is 360 euros billed yearly. Probably around the same for dollars. So you need around like 100 paying customers alone to get the 30K back. Is this correct?
Yeah.
Did I make the calculations correct?
Yeah, if you're running the math there, correct. Yeah, subscribers. Yep.
How many users do you have at the moment?
Yeah, so we got 9,000 and...
Oh, shit. Okay,
crazy. Yeah, I will say this. We do have a lot of lifetime customers because we have run deals with platforms such as AppSumo and Stack Social. Keep in mind, any listeners out there, if you do list lifetime deals, we know this failure rate is 92% with a SaaS business. It is now 99% if you run a lifetime deal. It's very hard on a business because it's a one-time payment, but you have ongoing costs. But we knew with our model, we could bring in a lot of people. And then they get access to the premium plan, which is tier one, tier two, which is premium plus, tier three is in advance. They have to become reoccurring subscribers. So it is a lead gen source to get them into the tool. And then they do naturally run into paywalls and upgrade from there. But just be very warned, if anybody out there does use AppSumo, there are a lot of risks.
It's so weird. Like, no one ever used AppSumo in Europe, who I talked to. But it seems to really be a big thing in the United States. Do you think like everyone is using AppSumo, or is it also a niche thing there?
We actually, for context there, we have a lot, because I know our footprint, we've got a lot of customers that use AppSumo all over the world. A lot of people from Europe, actually. A lot of people from Asia. Then you go to the South Pacific. So I'm thinking, you know, Australia, New Zealand. South Africa, like all over Africa, and of course US and Canada. So we're really spread out, actually. About 50% of our customers are from the US. The rest are spread out around the globe.
And you using AppSumo means, like, I made the math, like, if you have 9,000 customers having premium plus, I mean, there's also advanced, there's also premium, you would earn like around 2.7 million dollars a year, euros a year. Probably because of AppSumo, it's a little less.
You're
doing pretty well, though.
It's quite a bit less. We are not at the million mark, but we are in the six figure range. But we have a little bit of work to do from a feature standpoint. Like, we've got a web app right now. We're launching the iOS and Android apps here in the next 30 days or less. Then we'll have broker connections. You know, people can connect their broker, and when you make trades within that broker, they automatically update and ticker. So a bunch of fun stuff, long story short. So we know what needs to happen to get to that range. And we could talk about growth here in a second, but the big play is, like, B2C is one of those things that even Jason Cohen, he's a guy out there, you can look him up. He has mentioned that, hey, if you're thinking about creating a B2C, the answer is don't. It's very hard. Now, I like B2C more than B2B. B2B is touch. You have to be on Zoom calls. You got to be selling. You can go low touch, but the people that found the most success are like setting up between 4 and 8 Zoom calls per day, and they're selling. And I like the idea of selling with written words or video in high volume. So you got to use a lot of psychology. So I found the growth friction to be faster, but we want to partner with brokers to help more of their customers make more transactions. That's the big channel partner play. And that's where I have a lot of experience with large corporations. For context, there are a lot of small business owners get into this small business mindset and they think growth is with ads, Facebook ads or Google ads or YouTube ads. And that's a small business play. Like, hold my beer. Like, let me show you how it's really done with big businesses. That's when you can get in front of millions of people in like one day. So that's why the big play with Ticker is partner up with brokers.
What kind of brokers? Can you name a few examples?
Yeah. So I'll give you US and then global. So in the US, some of the top players are like, I use TD Ameritrade. There's also Robinhood. There's E-Trade, Fidelity, Schwab. Schwab now owns TD Ameritrade. Around the globe, the biggest broker from a footprint, not number of users, is Interactive Brokers. So no matter where you're located in the world, you can, most countries, you can sign up with Interactive Brokers and you can buy stocks from all over the globe. And that's what you want. Now, also in Europe where you're based, DeGiro is hot. There's also eToro is another good one. I think First Trade is another go-to one. And then in other parts of the world, like Alpaca is hot and
Okay, and you're going to these brokers and are like offering them like, please work together with me because I will create higher volume per person who's registered on your platform.
The sales cycle with this would be enterprise level is a little different. It's a little slower. I'll kind of step you through it here. So you can't sell them on words alone. You have to actually come to the conversation with data. So what I've done so far is build the relationships and let them know, hey, here's where Ticker's at and here's what's coming next, and say, I'm going to do the heavy work, but I'm going to show you data, for example, that shows when a customer joins Ticker, how many transactions are they making per month? And then over 3 months, does that number increase? And over 6 months, does that number increase? We want to visually show with data that, yes, the more people use Ticker, the higher their transactions. So if we could, you know, how brokers make money is transactions. They need their people buying and selling stocks. So we can show the data. That's the win. So that gives your listeners an idea like, hey, if you want to really help a channel partner, like somebody really big, is how can you solve a problem for them? But then before that, how do you present it with data to show the truth? Because as I talk to I know this industry pretty well, and people in corporate finance, they're like, they're not going to take my word for it. They're like, Sean, we got to see data. And I knew that already. So it's an alignment right off the bat.
And eToro, now, for example, because this is the one I know, where is Ticker then placed?
Where is Ticker placed?
So you're working with these brokers, and these brokers at some point like refer to you, that you get customers and that they get more volume per person. I got this correct?
Yeah, like they will introduce Ticker. Like an example, like eToro, which would be an awesome customer to work with, actually, is to partner with them. And how it would work is typically what you want to do is a pilot rollout. So first step would be show the data. Okay, so our customers do indeed increase the data. And then you do a pilot, which would be like an email marketing campaign from eToro, letting their audience know about Ticker. Only to a small segment, maybe 100,000 people, not like their millions of customers will go 100,000 people and then get feedback from those people. Like, do you actually like Ticker? Is it increasing confidence? Is it helping you buy more shares? And if it's positive, then they do a full rollout thereafter. And the revenue split there, well, there's two ways to make money in this case. There's a profit share. Like we have an affiliate program that's, you know, it's 30% for most people, and we can change that percentage to anything. So that's option one. They get a unique link. Option two is they would go into an enterprise, you could call it an enterprise fee of like how many users they would send us in year one, and then we would charge like a yearly fee. And prices at that point, when you get an enterprise SaaS, that's when it can be hundreds of thousands of dollars per year on up to millions of dollars a year. That's how that works. But so we'll see. I would prefer to go the profit share, because as they scale, we scale. But I'm open to enterprise as well.
But do you already have these kind of deals? Or is this just something where you're saying, okay, that would be really nice to having this cooperations and the synergies with these big brokers? I think probably I didn't got it 100%.
Oh, sure.
Already.
It's something that we're working on right now. For example, a roadmap is to get the mobile app out first. And then second is to show the data in it, like a dashboard for these enterprise players. So the dashboard, you could say it'd come next. And there's a lot of data we got to collect. So that's why, yeah, we haven't sold anybody yet. However, we do have channel partners at a smaller level, which I'd classify more as affiliates. And those are like, think of like a YouTube channel or a blog, or we did partner up with a Facebook group that has about 25,000 retail investors. And every post that's made, they're sharing their unique link. And every time somebody joins with that link, that Facebook group is generating revenue. So it's fun. It's you know, you want affiliate marketing built in. And Yuron, we actually went in our podcasting group. I work with Yuron, his SaaS business, Redditus. Quick shout out to Redditus, great platform. So yeah, if somebody's building a SaaS, I highly recommend you bolt on some kind of affiliate program.
Okay. So your marketing channels are affiliate. Your marketing channel is working with channel managers. We will soon talk about YouTube, which is, I think, one of your most interesting marketing channels. One last question to working with partners, working with brokers. If you're pitching, for example, to eToro, because this is the one I know, they are, I researched, they are generating $630 million revenue in 2020. So I don't got the number from 2023. If you're pitching to them, aren't you afraid that they are like, yeah, or go fuck yourself, we are building this ourselves, we spent $1 million and copying your service, aren't you afraid of it?
No, because large businesses, and I only know this because I work for large companies, they usually implore a buy before build philosophy. Yeah, so large businesses rarely will say, oh, we're going to go take money and we're going to build that. The reason is there's time is the number one factor. You have to build it, then you have to test it, you have to find product market fit. All of that to a more sophisticated executive team for a large company, they're going to say, hell no, we're going to buy that business. So what could happen with that play is they partner with us, or as I did talk to one broker, we would want to buy you out completely. So that's a conversation worth having. But yeah, like too many small business owners get in this mindset, like somebody's going to take my idea and try to build it. It's like, no, they're not. Especially a more sophisticated executive team. They're going to say, hell no. It's buy before build philosophy is used 99% of the time.
Is this something you ever considered, like selling your platform to?
Of course. My thing is, and I've got a really good relationship with a lot of my customers. In fact, I built a lot of good friends. I want to make sure they're set up for success. So if and when Ticker sells, I want to make sure the platform remains intact and has the right engineering team to continue building it. Now, there's going to be a handholding process where I'll probably have to sign a contract that'll probably be like a year or 2 years to make sure they're taken care of. And that's fine. There are situations where maybe a hedge fund wants to buy it. What they would do is close down the platform, use the algorithm, and then all the customers, if they want to use the tool, they got to go through them. But that would not be an ideal circumstance for my customer audience. So I believe me, I'm talking to people out there. I was recently approached by a company out of Chicago that wanted to buy me, and they wanted to break it down and use it for parts. And I was like, yeah, my customers would be pretty upset.
Yeah, because I mean, like 9,000 people in this kind of area, that's a pretty interesting base of users, I'd say. How long did it take you to get from zero to 9,000 users?
So I think it was 2020 when we went live. 2021, we got to about 2,000 people, 1,000 people, then 2,000 people in 2022. 2023, we doubled that. We went to 4,000 or 5,000. And then we're seeing some nice exponential growth. Like it's almost doubling per year. Like we're at 9,000 now. Could we get to 18 in a year? I definitely believe we can. SaaS is a special place to be. So yeah, we've started to hit momentum now. So it takes time. So it takes a lot of time though.
You got some hockey stick at the moment?
On user growth, on revenue, not as much because of those lifetime customers, but we're going to be turning off the faucet or turning off those lifetime deals very soon as our reoccurring revenue increases. What's nice about this is there's a few benefits of lifetime deals. You get capital injection. If you can't raise funds, which only 1% of businesses actually raise VC money, if you can't raise funds, go to run a lifetime deal, but for a limited time. So that's one benefit. Two is you can get fast feedback. And if you're a good product owner, like you are with your company you work for, it's like you want to be asking the right questions on how to make this platform better. So yeah, those are the two major benefits. But yeah, do not depend on lifetime deals to sustain your business, because they can actually crush your business. They can tank it. So you got to be so careful.
Do you wish sometimes you never did these, or are you like, no, user interviews, etc. are so good. Like it helped me so much to have users to talk to in the beginning.
Some days I tell myself like, why the hell did you do the lifetime deals? But the flip side, it's like, we got a lot of good customers. I made a lot of good friends, and we got really fast feedback on how to, because that's one thing you as a product owner can appreciate. We as founders should not put pressure on ourselves to make the perfect tool. You need to put that on the shoulders of your customers and ask them the right questions. Like, what do you like? What don't you like? What are you paying for on other platforms? And guide that ship in the right direction. So having, instead of like 100 people, having a few thousand people to bounce ideas off, it gives you more data and helps you find those edge cases faster so you can create a better tool. So I am, at the end of the day, I'm very thankful that I did move forward, but there are cons in the equation.
Okay, got that. Now to your marketing channels, because I think it's so hard. Like it's so fun and nice and lovely building these products. Monetization is like a thing which is hard, which can be hard, like what to take money for. And like one of the biggest and hardest things I think there are existing are getting users, just knowing that your product exists.
100%.
How are your different channels generating leads from the percentages? So how many users are coming through the brokers and the channel partners? How many users are coming via affiliate? How many users are coming via YouTube?
I'm going to bring up, I have data here to support this to make it even easier for us. So right now it's about 20% from channel partners. That's our number one. Number two is Google at 17%. So we have done a lot of work in the beginning on SEO. I actually do have a lot of experience there. But I tell people, don't lean on SEO as being your key driver. That's that long play you want in place. So that's starting to pay off. So that's 17%. 16% is YouTube, and it's growing fast. We just crossed 2,000 subscribers on YouTube. I love YouTube for marketing, because people go to YouTube looking to learn with intent. Like they know exactly what problem they have, and they're searching in there, and you can create short videos that solve that problem. So that's YouTube's number three at 16%. 15% is referrals from friends. And then it really breaks into little, this is a pie chart, into small pies. Like I've got a podcast, there's Facebook, but these percentages really drop from like 15 down to like 2%, 3%, a little bit from LinkedIn. So I really focus on the big ones: channel partners, Google, YouTube, and referrals from friends are it.
Okay. Also meaning like referrals from friends are more important than affiliate content from other publishers in your case.
Referrals from friends, what's nice is, and well, affiliates don't really cost anything, but it's time to get onboarded. But referrals from friends are number one. And I like this about B2C as well, because more people out there, you make it easier for people to share. However, if you have a really niche, let's say you have an SMB play, SaaS, that serves the logistics industry, like you could be like, let's say the person's name, it could be the marketing director at that company is Megan Miller. How many friends does Megan Miller have that work in the logistics industry? It's probably slim to none. But with our business, since it's B2C, kind of like Netflix, you go right down the street, probably a good majority of the people are interested in investing. Like Netflix, most people are there interested there as well. So yeah, B2C, I like it. You can create referral friend solutions. And we don't have anything built yet, but with the mobile app, we're going to be putting in some cool viral marketing tools, like refer three friends to get 3 months free.
Nice.
Yeah, little things like that. We'll create some triggers, but knowing that it's working, like we really want to lean into that. So you're right. Like that's where we should put a lot of effort.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and interesting, like comparing B2B and B2C, because we were also like with a few friends building a small platform for founders in Germany with HackMag with bureaucracy, that you can have an easy step-by-step guide. And it's so fucking hard finding anyone who wants to found a company. And now we're programming a little cookbook app. And that's so nice because we can talk to fucking everyone, like everyone buys groceries and like is cooking and food is a topic in real life. And I think that's pretty nice, like from a standpoint of, it's way easier to talk with people and to get first user input than this typical B2B.
B2B is tough
area. Okay, and with YouTube, because you're saying, okay, that's growing fast, that's your favorite channel at the moment. When I go to your YouTube channel, you have hundreds of videos, or probably 209 videos. So lots of them. Isn't that like a huge amount of work, like training a YouTube video?
Well, you want to create a schedule. Well, I learned years ago, and being a project manager, this is logical, is you never want to like look at it as a burden. So what I do is on Mondays, I'll write content and I don't write it word for word. I'll kind of create bullet points and then I'll carve out Tuesday afternoons are my day to batch record. That way I can knock out three videos. And the idea there is to record like three, maybe four videos and then hand it off to my team. And we do a combination of long and shorts. Short form are the, you flip your phone the tall way. And those videos should be 1 minute long and they go right to YouTube Shorts, Instagram Reels, Facebook Reels, and TikTok. So you're killing four birds with one stone. It's beautiful. And then the long form, that could be any length, but try to go like 10 minutes or less. There's not like you don't get promoted more or less depending on the duration. That was a rumor years ago, but that's not a thing. But it's just people's patience. You want to be 10 minutes or less. I do break that rule. Sometimes they're much more, but get into routine. That way you don't like destroy your schedule and get off base. But like if it's making money, carve out time, batch record. You never want to be in a position where you like record one on a Tuesday morning and then another one on a Wednesday afternoon. Another one on Friday. You're too unorganized then. It's going to, and it creates a situation where you have to, what I call gear switching. Like you got to switch your mindset to that type of creative behavior. You don't want to do that. So, Mondays are writing, Tuesday afternoons are recording.
Okay. How many videos do you create normally and how many blog posts do you create normally on a Monday and on a Tuesday?
So I'll write like 3 to 4 on Monday and I'll spend like maybe an hour or two on Monday afternoon. And then on a Tuesday afternoon is when I'll record those 3 to 4. So it's top of mind content. Like, okay, so I was talking about that yesterday. I can record it today and then that's it. I'm done. I can go work on other things throughout the rest of the week.
Did you ever thought about killing the text part? Because that's a thought I have at the moment because I really recognize, search engine optimization is getting harder since AI is existing. So I also had one guy here in the podcast who was like, and then I created for a customer, I think 40,000 articles, blog articles within 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And I think these are pretty good blog articles. I read them. Like AI is better than humans sometimes. especially with text.
Yeah.
Did you think about like killing the text part and just focusing on video?
We don't write any more blog posts or articles. I only write them on demand, but that was SEO we put in place probably the first 2 to 3 years. And then I pulled back because I was like, all right, we've got enough content here. Let's switch gears and really like lean into YouTube. So I actually don't do any writing. Like the writing I do, it's more like putting my thoughts down into bullet points. You'd be surprised on how short of content, because then when I'm doing the videos, so this is one thing too, is you never want to read. Like I ran into people that are like, oh, you should use a teleprompter. Like, no, you want to be authentic. You want to make mistakes. And you just like, that's why I'll just put my bullets down, read them real briefly. And like, and then I'll take like two to three takes and then I'm done with that video. So,
okay. So you're writing a script kind of with bullet points right on Monday, and then you're creating videos, but writing on Monday doesn't mean that you're writing 4 blog posts on Monday.
Gosh, no.
It means that you're okay. Okay.
I never want to go back to that. I used to write full on stock reviews, and then because of ChatGPT, we're actually thinking about a new product which would write a stock review for every stock and be really keyword focused, like Apple or Tesla or Microsoft. And we can automate that completely with technology. That'll be a project for a different day, but it's like, yeah, I'm done writing.
but also where I started for some time, like creating blog posts with AI, and I think they are really good. Like people probably cannot see the difference between a blog post I wrote and AI wrote, because I just trained AI with my texts and was like, yeah, this style, please take it, keep it short. Then you're really quickly done with a blog post. But two things, like, first of all, everyone else can do this as well. So there's so much more blog spam now out there. And second of all, like, yeah, why should people Google for it? They can just use ChatGPT if they have a question. So in the long run, are they really searching for that on Google? And I answer it for myself with no. I don't Google it anymore. Like ChatGPT is quicker. And I mean, right now it's quicker because I have a premium, but in the long run, it's just a time thing when ChatGPT in this premium version right now will be available for everyone. Okay. So you have a script, you have videos, and then you create like four to five videos. Your goal is to publish every week.
Correct. And we've kind of got an assembly line process in my team. So I will come up with the bullets. I will record, upload it to Google Drive. Then I have an editor that pulls it down and he will edit the long and short videos. And then he actually does the marketing as well, which is he'll kind of refine the show notes, the keywords, all that good stuff, and post. Like if we have 3 videos in a week, post one, don't post 2 on the same day, like spread it out. If you got, you know, 3 videos, post them out over 3 days. 4 videos, post them out over 4 days. 5 videos, of course, over 5 days. So that's kind of the process. That way you're staying consistent. That's a big thing with the YouTube algorithm, is stay consistent. Don't like post like 20 videos today and then 2 months later post more. It's like YouTube's not going to reward you for that. So you got to stay on it. Yeah. And then did you want to dive into any of the specific formulas? I've got some cool tips for titles.
Yeah. Go for it. I think it's a really new topic for me, but I think it could be useful.
So with titles, you want to be about 7 words or less, and try to use a number in there if you can, like 3 ways 2 or 5 ways 2 or the 3 biggest mistakes. That draws the attention a lot better for people searching. If you can also create some videos that are, because people, if you know the whole rule, like if you were to show people how to make $100 or show them what can cause them to lose $100, most people will click on the one that loses money because people are afraid to lose money or lose something, except for weight. but anyway, if you could do something like that, like, here are the 3, like in my case, I'd say here are the 3 biggest mistakes that cause people to lose money in the stock market. That's more than 7 words, but you get the idea. You can do a version of that. And then moving on to the thumb, you want to use about 5 words or less. Get rid of the filler words like the and a and of and stuff like mm-hmm. that. Like you can get creative there, but the idea is to make all caps letters, use a colored background, white text, maybe with a black score. And you'll see, like if you're jumping on my YouTube, you'll see a lot of those thumbnails, and make sure that your photo is front, like not front and center, but it should be waist up, which is in the movie industry, they'd call that a medium shot. It should be medium shot or close up. And the close up shot is like, that's when it's just the face. But if it's anything further away, you're going to be not as marketable, because the number one, believe it or not, the number one most marketable part of the thumb is the human being in it. Don't worry about other things. It's the person. And some people are going to be like, well, I'm not that good looking. It's like, no, you're missing the point. It's like people will attract to other people and their face. So what I do there is kind of like the batch recording. I'll do batch photo shoots, and I only do this like once or twice a year, but shoot like 30 different photos, like a shocked face or a surprised face or a smiling face or crossing arms or pointing in different directions. That way you don't have to shoot them. You just add them to Canva and then add your graphics, and then you're off and running.
Canva can do this, that it's cutting out your image easily?
What I do first, actually, because I just have the experience with Photoshop, is shoot your photos, get rid of the background, which a MacBook can do, which is beautiful. And then I added a white stroke around me. So when I put myself on a colored background, my image pops a little more. Just little details like this, just studying a lot of YouTube channels just go the longest. So then I've got all those photos saved that are already pre-cropped and they have the white stroke. So I literally, when I create my thumb, it takes me like 10 minutes, if not less. I just upload my photo. I know based on my title, I know what I need to put in the graphic, and I can kind of wordsmith so it's 5 words or less. Nice and big font. Try to fill that space. Don't allow for a lot of gaps. If you got really small text and a small photo of you and all this blank space, you're not doing yourself any favors. So you want a nice balance there.
Your most clicked video is, let me explain it. You looking a little bit skeptical, showing with your finger on $100 with a Palantir sign under it and the title saying, is Palantir going to $100? Do you think, how big do you think is the part of the video, and how big is the part of a thumbnail of this video going the most viral out of all your videos?
So talking, and I learned a lot of this from other YouTubers that are, we're talking hundreds of thousands of subs, and getting on Zoom calls with them and learning. And it's hard to say. Sometimes it's the thumb. Sometimes it's the title. The duration, like if you have a video that's continuously being watched, then it's not look, it's YouTube that's going to pump you out to more people. So that's why you want a video that has a really good watch duration. Now, just to take a step back with that video, that was great, but those views were within the first 2 weeks. But after that, it kind of fell off. And the reason is that's not an evergreen video. It's a snapshot in time. And I see this with a lot of people doing stock reviews. They'll be like, you know, Microsoft today or Tesla tomorrow. Doesn't mean it's going to be the same next week. And we were doing a lot of that, which gets a nice pump initially, but then the views fall off. And our goal for 2024, and it's working so far, we're going to create primarily probably 90% evergreen content. So if it's relevant today, it's going to be relevant a month from now or a year from now. That Palantir, the formula was simple. Show a stock, show a number you think it's going to, and then point to it. Like I could do that all day, but it's going to be very superficial, short-term traffic. And it's almost like clickbait, but it's getting in that umbrella, if you will, or that category. It's like, no, let's provide value, buckle up for the long term, and evergreen is where you want to be, because it's kind of like your SEO play. Like once you do it right and do it in the first place, it's not going to give you the right results today, but gosh, go out like a year and a half, 2 years, then you're going to be getting all this organic traffic. And that's when you thank yourself, like, okay, that worked.
One question which goes through my mind is, like I said, I think a lot about this because I think YouTube is a really interesting channel. I use YouTube myself a lot, and we have some things going on where I think, okay, that could be really interesting. YouTube is like an awesome channel to reach an audience who's really interested into something. And you easily can be better than AI because AI in videos is at the moment just bullshit. And there's also no relationship, no way to build trust at the moment. Let's see where Sora brings us in the next years. And I think... one thing which is blocking me from starting doing this is this feeling of, oh shit, my face is in the internet. I remember that I already was like really worried about this whole podcast thing. And now I see, okay, it's turning out great. Like most people in my family and in my friends group and whatever are not interested into startups and SaaS and... developers and all these interesting product management things and tech founders and like this little universe here is interesting for some people, but yeah, I only had good experience so far. Either people are not interested or they think it's cool and are happy about what I'm doing here. With YouTube, I mean, it's even more putting yourself into the public, and I also think, I mean, maybe it's different for you, but for example, in this context of building a company in Germany with all the paperwork stuff. I think, like, of course I'm more expert than someone who never founded a company, and I know the basic steps to do. But I'm also not a notary or a tax lawyer or something like this.
Sure.
So who am I to jump into YouTube and tell people what to do? But at the other side, I think for me, this would have been really useful some years ago. So I would have needed this step-by-step guide, and I made some mistakes on my way. How is your feeling about all of this? Did you ever wonder, like, who's watching these videos and this whole topic?
It was probably like 10 years ago I started to dabble with a little bit of video content for a different business, and I had that fear, like, oh gosh, I'm putting myself out there, and what are people going to say? And people have so many things going on in their day. They're going to watch your video and 2 minutes later, they're going to be worrying about, like, you know, their kid not doing well in school, or they've got this going on in their own business or a home repair. Like the mind goes in so many different, like you're going to be the furthest thing from their mind. So my advice there is, like, number one, don't try to emulate anybody else. Just be yourself and just whether you like it or not, somebody in your company, like especially if you're building a product company, whether it's a SaaS or e-commerce, there needs to be a face. Like you need to, like if it's not the CEO, it's got to be somebody, but they got to own it for the long term, because trust, and I've done studies on this, is trust was one thing in 2022 and went to a whole new percentage in 23 and 24. Like people need to relate to the CEO or this person on YouTube or who's ever in the media. You have to make yourself relatable. Like me, you'll notice I'm in finance. I wear t-shirts in every video. You'll never see me wearing a suit and tie. Like 1990s called and want their financial advisor back. Like, So you got to kind of lean, what are people looking for? And then just be the regular person. Don't try to be something fancy and just be yourself. I happen to be, I'm kind of an outdoorsman, and I don't get that fancy with material things. So it just happened to work out, but know your audience and just lean into that.
And I think then it's easier to be like, okay, come on, I give it a try, especially when it's not like a huge company everyone knows, which with a huge budget. There are some people like, I don't know, levels.io, where it literally doesn't make any sense that I'm using Nomadlist because I'm not a digital nomad. But for the times when I'm traveling, I really enjoy using Nomadlist and whole this network around, because I like levels.io. There's Flavio Copes, who's an amazing developer. And I know, okay, I learned so many things from him and his blog. So, of course, I feel more open for him, like jumping sometimes in his boot camps, because I really know, okay, I'm learning a lot from this. And that's crazy, because this
needs a lot of trust upfront, because it's not like Netflix where you have like a really small amount of money and it's like, yeah, okay, I make a first trial for 3 months and we'll see.
Sure.
Or Spotify or whatever. And I mean, Netflix and Spotify, you can even order from Vietnam or some country in South America for €2 a month or something. So the commitment is not that huge than paying like €360 per year. And I mean, that's needed for you to have a sustainable business.
Well, with our model, so just to jump back to pricing, and I won't talk too much on this, but this is really important. A lot of SaaS businesses get hung up and make mistakes with pricing. Mm-hmm. Our base plan is $15 a month or $99 a year. And we used to be a lot more. Like we were like $199. Prior to that, we're like $250 for the base plan. Mm-hmm. And this goes back to watching a video from Jason Cohen. He said, if you're thinking about doing B2C, don't. But if you do, the sweet spot price point in this worked because it took our churn from 11% to 5%, which is your base plan should be $99 a year. B2C isn't about charging what you're worth. It's charging what the consumer is willing to pay. B2B, you can charge, that's what you're worth. But we had to flip that equation in our heads and be like, okay, so we're a volume game. What are people willing to subscribe to and not churn out of? $99 a year and $15 a month. So the yearly is about a 3 month discount, maybe a little more. Mm-hmm. That worked like a charm, and then jump your prices up from there. So yeah, we go US dollars. We go from 15 a month to $50 a month. And then our highest level plan, which is $200 a month, people can find their journey within. And most people go for that premium plan. The premium plus has some cool features coming soon. So when you create a SaaS business, you have to nail your pricing. Like it is tough. And I tell you what, I wish we went with $99 a year in the beginning. It was brilliant. Watching that presentation from him, Jason Cohen, was brilliant.
You're talking about this MicroConf video? On could, YouTube correct. Or something That's, like?
I think it was MicroConf. Yep.
I will try to remember putting this link in the show notes. Is there something with the pricing? So you now switch to $99. Do you wish you would have made the change earlier? What is your advice to someone starting a SaaS business right now? How should the pricing be? Can you from the start take the pricing you have right now, copycat your pricing?
Pretty close.
And that's a good thing to do?
Especially for B2C, you probably can. Now, our middle plan is probably going to be a little more expensive. Going from 15 to 50 is quite a large delta. You could go to like 15 to 30, let's say. But yeah, for the base plan, that's a great starting point. And even for your lower touch B2B plays like a MailChimp, you know, email marketing platform, you start with a freemium model like they did, or something simple like ours, which is the, you know, the $15 a month or $99 a year. Seriously, it's the tier to start with. Get people warmed up, low friction. Then make sure you structure your features and your paywalls correctly thereafter. But you could look at Ticker as a pretty good blueprint. You could say this, we made the mistakes. Don't make the same mistakes we did, starting with different prices. We also tried at one point, and this was a mistake, is we had one price, which I've only seen one company successfully do, which is Headspace. And you don't want to do that because then if you add more third-party features like we are adding, you create very low profit margins and you can put your business out of business. So we had to add the premium plus and advanced tiers. And that actually worked out well for our audience because we used the correct communication saying, hey, we're adding tiers because we're going to be adding more features you guys want. But they're third-party features with third-party costs ongoing. So as soon as I sold it that way, our audience was like, oh, I get it. That makes total sense. But if it was like we created a new feature and then moving it to a new plan, then people are like, they would be like, as you know, you've got a tech background, and be like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
So
okay.
really cool talking about the pricing part, because that's, I think, one of the hardest decisions, because it's really hard to come back to that. We have this really famous startup, Komoot, from Germany, which is for hiking and like these kind of things, and cycling in the forest. And they, in the beginning, made something where you were buying maps, and then you were like onboarded forever for free. And now they really struggle like turning that back to like a subscription model, because they have to pay the loans, which is so sad, because it's one of the coolest companies I know. And I think just because they fucked up the monetization, they struggle grow like Strava does. Correct. Or like other cool outdoor platforms or running platforms do. The payment, there is one question left in my head. Like, the payment is fucking complicated if you're selling to different countries. Do you use a service provider for all of it? Or what is your solution here?
Yeah, this is a great question, because the solution is we use Paddle, and Paddle allows you to create what's called parity pricing. And what that means is you're logging in from Europe, you're going to see the prices on Ticker in euros. And then what we also do is we do a conversion rate. We actually use what's called the, I kind of use the phrase, Netflix index. There's people who are familiar with the Big Mac index. So, for example, if you live in India, you're not going to be charged $99 equivalent in euros. Okay. We're going to make that lower, because, for example, in the States, Netflix for one of their base plans, I think it's like $8.99 or $9.99. But that same plan, if you do the conversion in rupees in India, it's going to be like $2 or $3. So you have to do that. You got to use that index. So I did an exercise about 2 years ago. I looked at every single country. What does Netflix cost for the same price? And then I created the conversion rate based on Netflix. So thank you for doing the hard work, Netflix. But they're a business with, I mean, I'm doing a Google search here. How many users do they have? I think it's over 200 billion. Or I'm sorry, 200 million. Users on
260 million Netflix subscribers, hard word, in Q4 2023.
Yes. So, okay, so their volume play, and they're, in my opinion, best in class. They're very good. You want to emulate what they're doing. So yeah, we use Paddle. And what's beautiful about Paddle is they handle the cross-border taxes. That's one thing that a lot of small, inexperienced businesses aren't going to think about. Oh, I got to worry about taxes, sales taxes. With that, you want a tool that handles that. So don't raw dog it and use PayPal and Stripe. You're going to run into problems. You want to use a payment tool. Now, Chargebee is also good. There's a few other platforms like Paddle, but Paddle is brilliant. So yeah. So if you, again, if you log in from a country in Europe, you're going to see prices in euros, India's rupees, you know, Australian dollars, Canadian dollars, the list goes on.
And this managed everything for you? So you're just saying, okay, for this country or for this currency, I want this pricing? Or do you have to make some more thoughts on that? So is there more complication awaiting?
So what you can do is when you get in a Paddle, you can choose your price, and then it will convert right down the list automatically. But it's going to convert based on, let's say, $99 a year in this case. So what we have to do is, and this doesn't take too long, but you want to do things in Excel first, create your parity pricing per country, and then you put those prices into Paddle manually. So it's going to take you like an hour to work. But once you do that once, you're good. And the way I set up Ticker with the pricing plans is, again, that base plan, $99 a year, $15 a month, brilliant. And then I made it high enough at the middle tier and high enough at the advanced tier. I don't plan on changing these prices for at least a few years, even to account for inflation. And so I do recommend that with SaaS fund. If you put yourself in a position, like you said, with that hiking app or that outdoors app, when you code yourself into a corner, as I call it, and create problems with your pricing, you don't create a scalable business. It's going to be detrimental. So we wanted those tiers set up for the long term, so we don't have to send those surprise emails like, "Yeah, we gotta raise our prices." That Nobody loves doing that.
Yeah, and the thing with Komoot is, so they found a way to implement a new premium functionality. But I mean, like, so many users are using Komoot completely for free. And it's hard, like, taking standard functionality, which was free for years, away from the users. And it's really hard finding new edge cases like they have now. But if you plan a day, more day trip, Yeah, that's such a shame, because really cool team, cool people, cool application, and it doesn't happen often that I'm saying this. No, it's wrong. There are many, many cool startups about Germany, but it's like, Germany is not always a digital place, and really often it happens that cool startups go to the United States, go to Portugal, go to different countries where you have better infrastructure. And Komoot is like a nice little app from a nice little village called Leipzig in Germany, and yeah, it's such a shame. Okay, with Puddle, one question which comes to my mind: if you have different prices for different countries, maybe it's just me, but I always wonder, like, everyone has a VPN. Like, the only single use for paying for a VPN is that a VPN is saving you money, because you can go to different countries and then purchase products like from these other countries. Aren't you afraid of that? That people are like, that everyone, like, aren't there suspicious numbers that you have, like, crazy much users from India?
I have to say this. You are, like, without knowing, I would say, one, you're from Europe, and two, you're in tech from Europe, because that's a very European tech mindset. We do track the data a little bit, and it is like less than 2% of people are using a VPN to, going to log in. I'm in the US, and I'm going to log in from India to get the lower price. Like, most people, they don't do that, one, because they don't know how, and two, they don't like going through the steps of turning on their VPN and then logging in. I've met five other people that do it, and they are tech people who live in Europe. I don't know if it's a thing you guys learn from your parents or what. Like, unbelievable.
I also think probably I should change what I said. Like, I heard that a friend of mine is doing this. This friend of mine heard, or was seeing, or was telling me, like, it was not me, was telling me that also Netflix and Spotify and Disney Plus and all these different platforms, they only check the VPN, they only check your location whilst paying, and not afterwards. So you don't have to put afterwards VPN on. Okay, but I mean, probably chances are pretty high. Sometimes you assume from yourself on everyone else. If it's just like 1%, like, stupid people, like the friend of mine, then I think it's not a problem at all, right?
No, and even if it was a higher percentage, the answer to that is good. I hope they do, and I hope they go share their friends, because B2C, especially in this case, you want to make sure you're charging enough at each tier so you're profitable. But what's more important is volume. Like, so if we get 10 people to join legitimately, or 1,000 people to join with a VPN, do it with a VPN. Have at it, because we want you telling 500 of your other friends to come into the tool. So in other words, B2C is, and this is a pricing play too, is if you have the option to create a pricing plan where you join for free with no credit card, or ask for the credit card, you want the no credit card, because you want the lowest level of friction. You only ask for two things up front: name and email, and that is it. And there's studies there. Every time you add an additional field, you probably know this already, this is from like 2010, every time you add an additional field, your conversion rate drops by 15%. It's ridiculous. So get people in. So that's the lowest friction. If people want the VPN, fine, we don't care.
okay. Yeah, I mean, you're also doing pretty well. So probably if 1% of people are cheating, then that's it.
Hey, are you using the tool? More importantly, are you making money in the stock market? Great. Now tell five other friends. Bring them in the ticket.
Nice. What are your last question? What are your future plans with
Ticker. What do you wish to have in 5 years or 10 years? Or do you even plan the next 5 or 10 years?
As I kind of alluded to earlier, is the channel partner play will be big with brokers. What I feel could happen there is if we start helping we're talking 2 or 3 brokers and start doing a great job, that's when there could be a buyout offer. And I would entertain that. I have other things I want to do with my life. I think, you know, if Ticker were to sell in the next 5 years, that would be great. If it takes a little longer, that's fine. But I ultimately, of course, I want to make sure the customers are set up for success. The platform won't be stripped for parts. Everybody can use it. And I have other business ideas. I have other things I want to work on. So a lot of things I want to do in this life. I just crossed 40, so I still consider myself young. But there's a lot of cool
you
stuff.
You never thought about, like, when you have this great exit, just to chill on the Bahamas like US people do it?
You know, people always say that, but then when they do it in practice, you become stagnant. And I look for intellectual stimulation, so I like building businesses. I actually have a model that could be competitive to AppSumo. It could be quite disruptive, I'll put it that way, but it kind of combines crowdfunding, venture capital, and lifetime deals into one seamless model. And I don't see anything else out there like it. So that's probably my next play. And I could help a ton of businesses get off the ground running and raise capital faster. Because like I said, alluded to earlier, only 1% of businesses actually raise capital for their business. So that would be a ton of fun. That'd be my next venture.
Okay, cool. I hope that this is going well and then we have an exciting new podcast about an exciting new business in 5 years or something. Sure. Thank you so much for taking the time today. It was really interesting, like, jumping into this 100% open book about, like, building a SaaS thing. Really enjoyed that today and learned a lot. And I hope at some day I find the confidence also to do this YouTube stuff. I think that's really useful. Thank you that you do that. Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for being today on my show.
Well, thank you, Luis. We'll see ya.
Thank you so much for listening. If you liked today's episode, please give this podcast like a subscribe, thumbs up, good review, whatever. Whatever there is available in your podcasting platform. I really enjoyed learning so many new things and practicing my English. Sorry, today my English was a problem. But thank you so much for listening. Hope to see you soon again and have a wonderful evening.